get up and do my thing.
Go ahead.
I want to get into it, man, you know.
Go ahead.
Like, you know I'm the man, don't you?
Yeah.
Can I count it off?
Go ahead.
1, 2, 3, 4.
You're listening to the Church Politics Podcast with Michael Ware and Justin Gibney, where you can get in-depth political analysis from a Christian worldview. Transcend partisanship and political ideology with us as we seek true discipleship in the public square.
General John Kelly was the latest in a line of staffers that were supposed to come in and discipline President Trump, get some discipline in this White House. But he has had a difficult week. This is the Church Politics Podcast with Michael Weir and Justin Gibney. We're going to discuss that and more this week. Justin, how are you?
Hey, as the late Reverend Paul Jones used to saying, I won't complain. I have nothing to complain about right now. I had a really good weekend again. A good sermon at Greater Piney Grove Baptist Church here in Atlanta with somebody you may be familiar with or maybe not. We had a guest preacher named Harold Trulier. Came in to talk about mass incarceration. I believe he has a ministry called Healing Communities. And it was a really good sermon that reminded us how we should treat those who are incarcerated, and also reminded us how many of the saints had been incarcerated. And so just something to keep in mind. But it was a good start to the week, bro.
Yeah, he was a former head of the Howard Div School, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Well, that's really wonderful. My pastor's continuing to preach through Corinthians, and man, a book has him fired up. It was another really incisive sermon yesterday, and he closed with a Dallas Willard quote. So you know, I was.
I know you like that.
But Justin, maybe you won't complain, but John Kelly's had some good days in the White House, but last week he had some weary days.
That was a good segue, man.
Yeah. You like that?
I like that.
And it's been pretty difficult for John Kelly, and he's made things difficult on himself. We've had what's really amplified this. You know, he's a chief of staff, and he's allowed staffers to not just remain in the White House, but thrive in the White House. Rob Porter, who, full disclosure, I had several meetings with Rob Porter when he was in Senator Hatch's office. And so I know him. When I saw this story, I don't know him well. We haven't seen each other outside of work circumstances, but I was definitely surprised by the news. I think everything that we've read about him having, you know, a relatively sterling reputation among colleagues was something that I picked up on, even meeting with him for an hour or two. He was just a very impressive guy. So when I read about John Kelly being impressed with Rob Porter defending his work ethic, again, with very limited insight, but again, Rob is someone that I've seen work for a couple hours and been in meetings with. I can get that, but this is, I mean, from a political perspective, bungled. From an ethical perspective, it's just there's no excuse for it, and so this is the guy who was supposed to bring discipline to the White House. And in some ways he has. In other ways, we're seeing what happens when you put someone who hasn't been in a political job before into what many people call the second most important job in Washington, D.C., next to the president. So, Justin, what do you make of John Kelly's week, of John Kelly's tenure as chief of staff? And do you think he has a future in this White House?
Good questions. I do think he has a future. As you pointed out, he's had some sleepless nights and some weary days, I'm sure, in this last week. But, you know, again, he's the chief of staff. This is the guy who is supposed to control who and what the president sees and the decisions and what he makes decisions about. As we know, he started off as the Secretary of Homeland Security in this administration, and then he replaced Reince Priebus, who was only in the job as the chief of staff for 190 days. And as you pointed out, this is someone who's well respected. This is someone who we expect more discipline from and was actually supposed to bring discipline to the White House, as is still seen today by many of lawmakers as someone who is the grown up in the White House right now. And, you know, his resume is long, and we talked about it before. You know, he was a general in the Marines. He was the commander of the U.S. Southern Command under Obama, and he served this country for almost 40 years. So he has a resume there and some credentials. And I mentioned that I mentioned those accomplishments not because it absolves him of anything that we're talking about today. That's not the point. But because I think we should be able to critique him and disagree with him without being disrespectful or dismissive of his credentials. And today, a lot of times, it seems like once we want to criticize somebody, we have to tear every piece of them apart professionally, personally, spiritually, and all that stuff. And this is really just a critique of the job he's doing without taking anything away from the credentials that he has. When we talk about the Rob Porter situation that you were going over, it's problematic, very seriously. A lot of people have come out and say they were surprised that Rob Porter recently had to resign based on allegations that he physically and emotionally abused two of his ex-wives and a former girlfriend. Rob Porter is a Harvard and Oxford graduate, and people were surprised to see this, but I don't think there are any of those credentials stop people from being in these type of situations if the character and the self-control just isn't there. And to your point, the big question when it comes to General Kelly is, did he act soon enough? Did he do enough when he had the information? Now, if you ask Kelly, and reports are saying that he says that he secured Porter's immediate resignation within 40 minutes of fully understanding the severity of the allegations. This was based on, I guess, receiving photographic evidence. But other people are saying, some people even within the White House who some folks are saying they want to take him out because he's taking control from certain people. They said he knew something earlier based on a FBI background check. And so he should have done something much earlier. One of the big issues, and I'll pass it right back, that people are talking about, though, is the security clearance. That even though this man couldn't really pass a background check, he still was issued a limited security clearance, even though it wasn't permanent. It still gave him access to a lot of things that people are feeling like he just wasn't fit to have access to.
Yeah, I mean, so in some ways, you know, his low-key sort of profile, you know, in administration with a lot of flashier kind of personalities, and you know, we certainly had some flashy personalities in the Obama White House, but as a low-key sort of nose to the grindstone kind of reputation that Rob had, that's the role of staff secretary. You don't want a flashy staff secretary. And so in some ways you want someone responsible. You want someone who gets a wide range of issues. And so in some ways he's a good fit for the job. What makes you not a good fit is if you don't have security clearance. I mean, staff secretary sounds like such a benign position. It sounds like staff secretary. What people need to understand is in many ways, this is the gatekeeper to the president. Everyone who wants to get paper into the president goes through him. The staff secretary is the person ultimately responsible for the president's briefings. And so all of the paper that goes to the White House, whether it's confidential or not, is typically going to go through the staff secretary, which makes the security clearance issue even more important than a position that didn't have such broad access to the president and to the materials he receives. And it's a real problem.
And the other side of this is people were saying that maybe this puts him in a very vulnerable position when you have these kind of issues going on around you and someone, let's say, from another country gets a hold of that. well, maybe they can put you in an awkward situation that would force you to compromise your job. So those are some of the things that people were bringing up in relation to Porter and why this whole situation was problematic, especially in regard to Kelly, who has been working at such a high level. He should understand the risk and the problem with giving this kind of clearance to someone who's in this position. The other thing we have to talk about with Kelly is the comments he made in regard to quote unquote lazy immigrants. He was asked a question about the president's perspective on the DACA issue. We've been covering the DACA issue quite a bit. And his response was this. He basically said, look, he was stunned that there are about 690,000 official DACA registrants. Okay. And the president, he said, the president came out and said, look, you know, there's an offer of 1.8 million out there. And so he's saying for the people who actually didn't sign up, either they were afraid or they were too lazy to get off their behind. Now, he didn't use the word behind, but he was basically saying they were too lazy to actually sign up. He was later asked again, and he doubled down on these comments. One thing I would like to say is hopefully those who have been following this show for a while have heard that we do try to be charitable towards people and their statements, but not to a fault, right? Not to the point where we're dismissing or candy coating bad behavior. And when it comes to General Kelly's comments, I think they deserve to be called out today because they lacked that charity that we're talking about, and it lacked that charity towards immigrants. Now, this is a really tough conversation. It's coming at a really tough moment in this immigration debate. And you would think that General Kelly would have an appreciation for that. And his comments just were not helpful in the way that they were expressed. Now, this is in no way to suggest that we should all speak in euphemism. I can actually appreciate the kind of military bluntness and tough words at times. And maybe that comes from my football background. I know some of the hardest lessons that I had to learn couldn't have been spoken to me in a really soft tone. Sometimes you just have to be real and blunt. But within this conversation, I think the comments were just wrong. They weren't constructive. And on a subject that really needs more thoughtful dialogue. And so someone who is known as a kind of a disciplinarian, I don't think this was a very disciplined comment. And hopefully something like that wouldn't be said again, because it just adds, you know, it adds to the heat of an already very hot conversation.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. Dan Balls had a really wonderful article in the Post about John Kelly that I think was really balanced. I think he acknowledged the discipline that John Kelly's brought in some ways, but in the end, you know, Balls kind of concludes that Kelly's expression of confidence and self-confidence, and I'm quoting now, has again been called into question under an especially harsh spotlight. And that when Kelly sort of was talking about how he didn't allow staff to pay attention to Twitter during the spat with Kim Jong-un, when he said that, you know, we know what we're doing, you know, that's being called into question, again, acknowledging the fact that this is probably one of the top brightest military leaders that this country has had over the last two generations. Yeah. And so we definitely want to acknowledge that. But the White House has been having a pretty difficult week after, you know, again, I think we said this on the podcast. The State of the Union was nothing like many of us expected, and had they not been caught up in two government shutdowns and some of this other controversy, the follow up to the State of the Union could have been quite a bit more than what we've seen. But I do want to, before we go to break, I do just want to circle back to Rob Porter. I think I opened up by commenting on him through the lens of John Kelly. But anyone who's seen these pictures, and anyone who's heard sort of the back and forth, who's heard from Rob Porter's ex-wife, who's been in the press and has been writing and explaining in the op-ed why she stayed, just has to say the idea that there was any tolerance for this, that John Kelly or anyone else could have heard inklings, if that's what they heard, or heard mumblings that Rob Porter was involved in domestic abuse and not followed up and decided to sort of put that on the shelf for a while. It's people have the right to be outraged at this. They have the right to say that people serving in White House and serving in government ought to be held to a higher standard, not a lower standard. Just because Rob Porter or anyone else can do their job doesn't mean that they get a free pass or get leniency when it comes to something this serious. And so I just wanted to circle back to this. And it was shocking to see photos like we saw this week. And again, just have something like that associated with our country and with the White House.
That's right. It's unacceptable. If Kelly knew about it earlier than he's saying, then he should have done something earlier. We saw Saturday morning, Kellyanne Conway, a lot of the Trump administration folks were coming out in support of him on the Sunday morning shows. Even Jay Johnson, a former Obama Homeland Security secretary, said Kelly should stay more so for practical reasons than moral reasons. So you're hearing both sides. Some people saying he should stay. I don't think he's gone. We'll have to see. But certainly Porter had to go. And I wish that decision was made earlier, but at least it was made. And hopefully they can move on from there.
Yeah. You know, the last thing I'd point out is that, you know, this is an administration that on the policy side, you know, some people have expressed concern that they aren't being as aggressive on domestic violence as previous administrations. Under the Obama administration, there was an advisor on violence against women in the White House that was responsible for coordinating a national strategy to make progress to prevent domestic violence. And this administration cut that position, does not have that position. And so, you know, there are different positions in different White Houses. I don't want to say that because they cut this position, they don't care about domestic violence. But you add that to the fact that you have a president who talks about women often in demeaning ways. You have one of the most senior officials having to resign over accusations for domestic violence. Sometimes the policy and the personnel issues, match up. And I think people have an ability to and the right to point out those connections. So with that, we'll take a break. When we get back, we have so much more to discuss, including the budget deal, Liz Brunig's pretty interesting column on paid leave that we discussed last week. And then, of course, we'll talk about the Olympics. We'll be right back.
This episode of Church Politics is brought to you by Eastlick Coffee, a coffee roasting company serving specialty coffees that are unique yet familiar, complex and comforting, featuring diverse origins that are delicious and approachable. Use the code FORTH, that's FORTH, to get 40% off your first bag of coffee by visiting eastlickcoffee.com.
And we are back with the Church Politics podcast. Last week we saw a budget deal get passed after more drama, after another sort of brief government shutdown that was provoked by Senator Rand Paul. But now we have a we have a budget deal that kind of clears the decks, as CNN reported, for Congress to deal with major spending issues and doled out disaster relief money. And we saw the debt ceiling hike, which was a major contention of Senator Rand Paul's a filibuster. Justin, does this deal make sense for the American people? What was it, you know, really accomplished in your view?
Given what's going on in that dynamic in Congress, I think this deal does make sense. It's hard to see getting a better deal done than this. Given the moment. And so that's not to say this is the best deal I've ever seen, but I was glad they got some things done and they're not going to have to redo it, you know, 2 months down the line. Right. Like you said, Trump signed this on Friday to avoid or actually to end a very brief shutdown that most people didn't know about because it was just a few hours. And this 600 page document actually raised spending by hundreds of billions of dollars. A good portion of that spending was military spending. And there was about, to your point, there was about $90 billion in disaster relief. And we know that we've had several different disasters from Puerto Rico, Texas, and all over. And so it's good to see those disaster dollars getting to where they need to go. I know that there were churches that were advocating to get those dollars out. So congratulations to those churches who've been putting in work trying to get these folks to do the right thing. And I hate that people had to wait so long, but it's good. Those are finally flowing. And as you mentioned, Senator Rand Paul caused that brief shutdown by holding up the vote until 3 a.m. And he was very serious. He was trying to make a point. I think one of his quotes was, you know, the reason I'm here tonight is to put people on the spot. He said, I want people to feel uncomfortable. I want them to have to answer to the people at home who say, how come you were against President Obama's deficits? And then how come you are for the Republican deficit? So what we're seeing here is these deficit hawks are they're taking a lot of shots and are not really wanting to allow this to go on without people feeling that this is an issue that needs to be addressed. And I think the deficit does matter. So I get people trying to make the point that don't just keep raising spending without matching it with some serious, you know, some other serious policy that helps us talk about the deficit. And it was a close vote. You know, in the House, 67 Republicans voted for it and 73 Democrats. So you see a situation where there were more Democrats in the House voting for it than Republicans, and Democrats voted for it, even though it didn't have DACA in there. And they wanted to have that conversation about DACA in that particular legislation. The other thing I would just bring up is, you know, today that Trump is releasing his budget request. And so that should be an interesting conversation as well.
Yeah, I think so. I do want to point out, the way this budget deal went down, I think is significant. The first is it shows again that Republicans are willing to spend money as long as it's their money. You know, if they have the reins, they're willing. Raising the debt ceiling is fine. Spending hundreds of billions of additional dollars without the cuts is okay. We saw this under Bush. We saw this. We've seen this before. So this is just in that way. You know, this is just something coming up again that we've known for a long time, that Republicans tend to care about the deficit, with some exceptions like Senator Rand Paul. Republicans tend to care about the deficit when Democrats have control, because it's an argument to use against Democrats being able to pass budgets and that kind of thing. But if Republicans have control, that money is easier for them to spend. And then the second thing I'd point out, which I think might be new, is we're seeing a Republican party that, even more than in the past, is willing to concede in favor of budgetary goals and budgetary priorities of the Democrats, but has become hardened around social issues, particularly, you know, in this case, in immigration. So Democrats got the disaster relief money, There's billions of dollars in child care funding. That's a part of this. $10 billion in infrastructure. And yet still no vote on DACA as a part of this. And so, I think we're seeing a bit of a transformation in the Republican Party, not just policy wise and not just depending on who's in control, but towards a more socially focused Republican Party that's become a bit unmoored from some of the conservative economic principles that used to really be the driving force behind the party. And, you know, I think that there are definitely some upsides to that, but it's something to acknowledge, and it's something to remember the next time Democrats are in control and Paul Ryan's talking about budget deficits again.
Yeah, the inconsistency is definitely worth mentioning. Because it really shows you that at certain times we're complicating the process when it's really not necessary. We're saying things that are a matter of principle when they're really just a matter of partisanship and who's making the policy recommendation, right? Yeah. And so those things need to be pointed out, and hopefully we can avoid those. I don't necessarily agree with Senator Paul, but I understand why he called that out. I think it's good that he called it out. If we're saying this is what we're about, if we got voted into office based on us being caring about the deficit and not just, you know, blowing it out of proportion, I mean, blowing the deficit up rather, then we need to be about that. And so I think that was an honest, good faith move that he made. And I get it. Just like you, I wish DACA was in there. However, I'm still hopeful that maybe there can be an a larger immigration agreement. All this kind of coincides with the immigration debate that's going to be going on in the Senate today. Right. And so it should be interesting. Again, Trump is releasing his budget request on Monday. There's supposed to be $23 billion in border security and immigration enforcement. And this includes the wall. There's supposed to be spending cuts to the State Department and the Environmental Protection Agency. And so we know that'll give some people a pretty big headache. And then there's supposed to be regulatory cuts that are supposed to catalyze about $1.5 trillion in infrastructure spending. It's important to point out that they're expecting most of that spending to come from the private sector and only about $200 billion, I think, coming from the government. So we'll see how that works out. Something else to talk about in the budget request that's being released today is the $85 billion for veterans medical care and the $17 billion that's for the opioid crisis. And so there are definitely some things that those are definitely some things that need to be addressed. And so I'm glad we're doing that. But this all goes into a broader conversation and really seeing how they flesh out this budget and what the priorities of this administration are going to be when it comes to spending.
Yeah, it's... Justin, the flip side of this, right, is, you know, budget deals are perhaps the clearest example of the fact that there are no perfect decisions in politics. Republicans definitely gave up a bit on quite a bit on spending priorities. Although you just noted, you know, they're still in control. So Democrats are, as a minority party, Democrats are just going to take more hits regardless. And that's just the process. But even with that, in order to pick up Democratic votes, some Democratic priorities were met. But then Democrats voted for this and took hits from their left for allowing it to move forward with kind of a promise from Senator McConnell to take up immigration as opposed to what some activists were urging, which was to use this budget deal as the major leverage point to force a decision. At one level, I just everyone involved made some difficult decisions, and there are ways that you could agree and disagree. I mean, I think it's really difficult when when you have elected officials that are using such heated rhetoric around DACA and then kicking the can down the road. You know, I can understand why that gets difficult for folks. Another perspective, you know, when you're an elected official, you don't have the luxury of just focusing on the deficit or just focusing on immigration. You're responsible for a wide range of priorities. And at the end of the day, they you know, the government's running. And so I think it's just helpful to look at a budget debate as you can critique this, critique that. But if it was your vote, if you were responsible for deciding whether, you know, federal employees, many of whom probably live in your district, you know, will get their checks, their paychecks, you know, how would you vote? We'll see what happens this week with immigration. I think Democrats will be absolved from the left of their party if a DACA deal gets done. I think they'll the budget fight will be forgotten if a DACA deal doesn't get done. We could see some backlash within the party for Democratic leaders, particularly Senator Schumer, deciding not to use this as a major, you know, as a Waterloo kind of moment. With that, let's take one more quick break, Justin, and we'll return to talk about the Olympics and about Liz Brunick's column. We'll be right back. We're back with the Church Politics Podcast. Justin, did you get a chance to watch the Olympics at all over the weekend? You catch opening ceremony or any of the events?
I didn't actually catch the opening ceremony, but me and my oldest son yesterday did catch a bit of the men's 5,000 meter speed skating event. And so I am trying to catch a little bit more of it in the coming days. You all might know that this is the 23rd Winter Olympics. It's in Pyeongchang, South Korea. I just looked at the, you know, we always got to check out who's winning in the medal race. And so I just looked at the medal race, and the United States is presently in fourth place, with two golds, one silver, and one bronze. So let's hope we step it up a little bit more and get in that first spot, where Germany is now in first place at the moment.
Wow.
Something else I also want to check out is, you probably know, Nigeria has its first bobsled team. So hopefully I can check them out when they get a go.
Yeah, it's gonna be a lot of fun. I thought the opening ceremonies were really beautiful. I thought they told a really sweet story. I mean, similar to previous opening ceremonies, I liked it. The ability to view things through the eyes of children was pretty cool. And so I think that's always a touching way to go about it. And then, Justin, my wife loves the Olympics. And so, you know, we've been doing the snowboarding. We did the downhill skiing yesterday. I these 2 weeks, I gotta, you know, buffet myself for all the ice skating I gotta watch. Although, you know, if you injected me with truth serum, I don't mind it all that much.
You're on your own here, bro.
That's right. I'll tell you what I love. It kind of reminds me of college, of March Madness, in that, you know, you only have a limited, you know, unless you're a diehard college basketball fan or diehard, you know, ice skating, whatever. Really, America gets, you know, 2 weeks in March Madness. It's, you know, like a month with these young people. And you really end up falling in love with some of them. So I learned that this, I believe she's 17, Mame Biney, who's a 17-year-old speed skater. She's actually from the town where we live, from Reston, Virginia. And if anyone caught her on the opening ceremonies during her interview, and then the last I saw, and I may have missed something, but she got through the heat, through the first heat in her speed skating match. And the girl is just a ball of sunshine. I mean, she just made me so happy, and I'd never heard of her before. And there are just so many young people that are doing incredible things and just have great personalities. And so that's what I love about the Olympics is you get these, you get to meet all of these amazing young people who have dedicated their lives to sport, to expertise, to being able to be really proficient in something, and this is their moment to shine. And you know, we saw Adam Rippon kill it last night in the team skate, and so it's always a cool 2 weeks when the Olympics come around.
I agree. The Olympics always give you a chance to watch sports that you would otherwise never have an interest in. I think almost every sport when it's the Olympics is somewhat interesting, and that's a great opportunity because, you know, I'm not going to be watching the man speed skating any other time, but I find an interest in it because it's the Olympics and because it's such a big deal. So yeah, it's been great. I want to catch more of it. Just hadn't had the chance, but hopefully when I get the chance to sit down later, I'll catch some more and the U.S. can kind of come up in those standings. Yeah. Something else that happened that was interesting was, you know, we know that, again, this is in Pyeongchang, South Korea. And during the open ceremony, I didn't get to see it, but I'm guessing that you did. South Korea and North Korea walked together under a reunification flag. And this flag apparently shows a united Korean peninsula. Now, many people were praising this. I think a lot of people were saying, well, this is great. We want to see unity. We want to see people come together, and we get that. But I heard that some conservative groups in South Korea weren't happy at all. In fact, some of them were actually burning the reunification flag, basically saying that it undermined them as the host country and kind of romanticized the situation, and understanding that Kim Jong-un is not a very nice guy. There's not a good relationship. So why act like we have this great relationship when that just simply isn't the truth?
It's been weird, man. I mean, I think that's the best thing I could say. I mean, it's so odd when, you know, when the evening news is on some of these channels, typically, they're trying to drive up fear about North Korea and trying to increase a sense that the North Korean regime is, you know, dangerous. And then the Olympics come around and they're trying to get you to tune into sports, and they're trying to get you to be happy about the Olympics. And, you know, in some cases we get pure hagiography on North Korea and what exactly it means that the Koreans have formed for one Olympic team, and that, you know, his daughter-in-law or whoever is there at the event. It's been a really good example of how market incentives can drive some of our commercial media, particularly, you know, the TV channels who are trying to get ratings. I mean, it's kind of a bummer, of course, to talk about the North Korean regime, but kind of give them a PR coup is not something I'm looking for either. So I think there's been some good commentary. What'll be interesting is, you know, it'll be really interesting to see this evolve over the next 2 weeks. And so, you know, will NBC feel compelled to air, you know, in prime time, a 10 minute mini doc on exactly what the status is in, the state of things are in North Korea, and because the Olympics play out over such a time period, there's a chance that pressure can build that we'll see some reaccommodations to and different approaches than what we saw in the opening ceremony in these first few days.
Yeah, a lot of conservative commentators were also commenting, and you mentioned it briefly on Kim Jong-un's sister and the star treatment that she was given from a good portion of the American press. Yeah, it was his sister. And she was given the star treatment from a good portion of the American press. And they're like, come on, guys, let's not get into this, you know, this starry-eyed stuff. Let's focus on what's really going on. And I think we, from what I could tell, we did go a little bit overboard in that regard. So hopefully we can find some middle ground where we're not making everything about politics, but at the same time, we're not romanticizing a very bad situation and some pretty bad people as well.
Right. Yeah. Justin, to close, I think we wanted to circle back on paid family leave conversation. This is really important policy conversation. And I think last week we wanted to acknowledge and lift up the serious policy approach that Senator Rubio was taking to try to find a way to get paid family leave done in a way that could get the support of his party that is in control of Congress. We wanted to lift up and still want to lift up efforts to get advanced good policy in a way that can get done and that isn't just about posturing and about sort of setting yourself apart from your colleagues and your peers. He was, again, just to recap, the basics of Rubio's proposal is that it would be a cost-neutral way of providing paid leave benefits by basically drawing from folks' social security accounts. So if you had to take care of a sick family member, if you're having a child, we don't have a federal paid leave policy that is sufficient right now in this country. And Rubio said, well, as a cost neutral way, let's take it off Social Security. I think probably in his mind, he's thinking Social Security needs reform anyways. The age limit hasn't been risen, been increased in a very long time. And so so when you take advantage of paid leave, you take 6 months of Social Security away. Liz Brunig writes a column in the Washington Post that is critiquing the basic exchange that's happening here, which is that those who choose to have kids have to give up their Social Security or give up 6 months of their Social Security just so they could take care of their kids and be home with their kids for 6 months. And Liz's point is really that this is not a parent's family rearing is so fundamental to society that those who choose to raise to have kids or raise kids shouldn't have to. Society shouldn't force them to give up something on the back end just so that they could take care of their kids on the front end. And I thought Liz's column on policy grounds is really worth considering. In other words, we could affirm that Rubio is trying to get something practical done and trying to sort out ways to get paid family leave through Congress as it is currently situated. But Liz's pushback here, I think, is effective. Now, it's interesting. Senator Rubio tweeted out her op-ed and said that he appreciated the sentiment, but he's concerned about getting something done. And this is something that's feasible. And so this is just a really good example for people to sit with of how two well-meaning people can disagree really well and feel morally driven in different directions. You know, I'll let you cut in there. But what did you think of Liz's column? And I'm just really fascinated and want to leave our listeners with just the complexities of this debate that we see all the time in politics, which is sort of principle versus pragmatism.
Yeah, well, Brunig is a brilliant writer. This isn't the first time that we've talked about some of her work because she does such good work. I like the way that she started the conversation off where she talked about, look, in the ancient world, what they understood. And she even brought up St. Augustine I enjoy anytime someone brings up St. Augustine, but she said, look, in the ancient world, families were seen as a key to a functioning society and actually seen as kind of small societies within themselves. But she says today we're more focused on individuals. And I think you and I would both agree on that. She even went to go on to say that a lot of our policy is absurdly individualized. Mm. And then she kind of goes into this Rubio Ivanka plan, if you will, which again would allow parents to get money, but then it would come out of their Social Security, so they would get the money a little later, not upon them turning the age that would make them eligible. And so I think the policy, the ideal policy, I think I'm with her. I think our ideal policy would be very similar. I don't know that Senator Rubio's ideal policy would be that far from where she is, right?
Right.
But I'll say this. Where I disagree with this article is saying that it's penalizing someone. Because you can't really penalize someone when you're talking about a voluntary program, right? So no one's going to say you have to take this money and then you have to get your Social Security later, right? This is giving people the opportunity to do it, knowing that they may get their Social Security six weeks later or whatever. So also keep in mind, this isn't like, okay, you're going to get your Social Security like 10 years later or something like that, right? The people would know exactly how much time it's going to take for them to get it. So I think that's a little bit of a stretch. The other thing I would say is anytime when we're assessing policy, we need to look at a few things. Where are we at now? And where we're at now, where the American people are at now, is you may have a baby or something else, and if you take time off, you may get nothing.
Right.
That's where we're at now. The other thing you have to look at are the opportunities, which I think goes to Rubio's point. We've got to get something done. And as great and as much as I like the policy that she seems to suggest, that policy is not getting through Congress anytime soon. I don't know that it's getting past the president's desk anytime soon. And so I don't know that she was necessarily dealing with reality. What I saw was I want a policy that's a little more robust. And here's how we can do it. And this is why I don't like that policy. But to say it punishes people, she says the plan would penalize the elderly for having kids. I think that's a little too far, although I get what she's saying. It just comes off somewhat as hyperbole because this is a voluntary thing and people would know the delay that came with it. And it gives them an opportunity that they wouldn't have beforehand.
Yeah.
So not right. The perfect policy, but if you can get something like this passed, you're not going to get necessarily what Brunick is pushing at passed at this day and time.
Yeah. I think that's, I think that's right. My pushback would be, it's not an intentionally sort of punitive policy. Like you said, these are benefits that don't currently exist that would be made available. But plug in these economic incentives and disincentives and the cultural signal it sends, you know, over the course of a generation. And think of a government that is sending the message that, well, if you want to do what, you know, every industrialized nation around the world does, which is, you know, have time to stay with your kids when they're first born and not lose your pay or lose your job while you're doing it. Then you have to work longer than your peers in order to retire and receive your social security benefits. I do think that there's at the very least, in addition to the 6 month time period and the practical penalties involved, there's a cultural signal that sends that, you know, child rearing is just kind of a choice that people make. And if they're going to make that choice, they have to make some sacrifices. And instead of, you know, what Liz is, I think, trying to facilitate here, which is the idea that actually child rearing and families are the cornerstone of society and ought to be they ought to be incentivized, not disincentivized. And so, you know, this is one of those interesting things where
Can we really call this a disincentive, though? Because you don't have to take it. And honestly, I think a lot of people would see it as an improvement from where we are.
I think
so. Again, as I said before, I would my policy stance would be very similar to her. Right. But based on where we are now and the dynamics in Congress, I think this actually could put people in a better situation than they're in now. And I don't know that they would see it as a penalty, because it's something that they could take on voluntarily and say, well, maybe I plan to work a little longer, or it's worth it for me to do it, or it's not worth it. So I get that. But I think it's just hard to say it's a penalty or putting people in a worse situation.
Yeah,
but I definitely hear you.
I think a lot of people, you know, let's say you have, you know, kids at 32, 35, younger. I think a lot of people are going to end up, taking that and, you know, and then paying for it, you know, 30, 40 years later when they reach, when they hit retirement age. And so it's, I'm in a great, you know, if the choice was between this Rubio plan and the status quo, and there was a vote, I think I'd, you know, knowing what I know about the plan, I think I'd probably vote for it and be proud of that vote. I think Liz, and you know, I think Liz is right to say, is this really the deal we have to make? We just passed a budget that, you know, has hundreds of billions of dollars of additional military spending, and yet we're telling individual families that if they want to stay home with their kids, they got to give up 6 months of Social Security. Yeah. And I think always pushing on those frameworks is a good thing.
We could think of this too. So let's say you're a congressman and you vote for it, and then the midterms come up and you get a challenge from the left saying Michael Ware penalized people with family.
Right.
I mean, that's basically what's being suggested here. So if you voted for it, I mean, this an article like this could almost make a Democrat or someone else not want to necessarily vote for it, because you could get attacked from that angle. And I'm just, if you voted for it, I don't think that would be a fair attack.
Yeah.
Because I don't necessarily think it's a penalty, nor is anyone voting for this thinking that they're punishing family. And so that's where I'm coming. And that's why I feel like it's somewhat hyperbole, because that's not why people would vote for it. And that's not the point of what Rubio and Ivanka or whoever else are trying to accomplish.
That's right.
So that's where I'm coming.
That makes a ton of sense. Hopefully that conversation is helpful to listener. I mean, it's, again, and so many people are getting interested in politics and getting motivated by issues, it can get really easy to sometimes, you know, have the point of view that, well, I really care about this issue and I think this thing. And so therefore, if you don't think this thing, you don't care about the issue. And, you know, that's not the way things work in politics. I think Liz Bruning and Ivanka Trump and Marco Rubio all care about helping families out helping to give parents greater ability to spend time with their kids. And the policy means of going about it are just going to be different, and we need to debate those. But things are just so much more complex than the fundraising emails that get sent out. So with that, Justin, do you have any final words, anything you're looking forward to this week?
Man, I am just in frontline discipleship mode. We have a frontline discipleship tour for the AND campaign coming up. Our launch is on February 23rd here in Atlanta, Georgia. So if you are in Atlanta, Georgia, join us at Greater Piney Grove Baptist Church. Our keynote speaker will be Dr. Tony Evans. And we will have some of the best and brightest rising faith leaders that are going to be speaking before him and just really touching on why Christians should be at the front lines of the most serious conversation. So for the next 2 weeks, I'm just in that mode trying to get ready for that event.
That's going to be amazing. Folks, if you're in Atlanta, be sure to check that out. I'm heading home I'm driving to Buffalo this weekend for a cousin's wedding. And so, you know, hopefully the roads do me some favors and we don't have too much ice going on, but I'm always happy, as you know, to be back in Buffalo. They're probably still celebrating the Bills getting into the playoffs. And so I'll just I'll just tag up to one of those parties. All right, folks. This is the church.
Hey, be safe, bro.
Yeah, I will. I will. I won't be jumping through tables or nothing.
Good stuff.
This is the Church Politics Podcast. We'll be back with you next week. Until then, be blessed. For the activists and graduates, I'm an advocate for those feeling abandonment in the favelas and slums of ghetto inhabitants. It's like, can anything good come out of Nazareth? The only thing good came out of Nazareth. This is the groove. Tell me, can you handle it? I'm schooled in the ways of runaway slaves. I'm brave, I'm unchained, I'm Frederick Douglass with a fade.